Chapter 12. Vengeful Spirit. I did not wish to land at random. Something had called us here, and I meant to find it before making blind planetfall. Our attempts to vox through the cloud cover went unanswered, as did any psychic reaching attempted by either myself or Asher Kai. We spent 2 days and nights looking for where to land. The dream was no aid, for it never came again. 2 days. And we were fortunate to have managed it even that quickly. Gunship sweeps and fighter reconnaissance across the planet's continents were our only options, with the atmosphere too dense to allow for reliable scanning. At first we found nothing but low-hanging storm clouds and dead frosted rock. The world seemed locked at a single point in time, with the clouds never moving on and the acidic rain never dissolving the ice-rimed ground. The snow would hiss and burn away, only to freeze over again almost at once. We were a new element to that supernatural formula, and the rain certainly affected us. Our fighters returned after every excursion, freshly ravaged from the acid storms. Our gunships fared even worse. After one such run, I met Ugrivian on the deck as he clambered down the ladder from a Prosperine Sundagger's cockpit. Servitors and hangar crew worked around us in a mumbling storm.
"This world is a tomb, sorcerer," he said.
I feared he was correct. We sought anything at all. A settlement, a city, a downed vessel, anything that could have been the source of the astropathic cry. Descending below the cloud cover made no difference to our instruments. The tormented world wreaked havoc on every Auspex sweep. At last we found it. One of the servitor-piloted fighters docked back aboard the Talok, exploding grainy picked captures of a downed ship, half buried in the snow at the bottom of a deep ravine. From the worthless image quality, there was no way of telling what the vessel was, nor how long it had been there.
"To give you an example of scale, that canyon could house a city of 9 or 10 million people."
Asher Kai said those words as we gathered around the command deck's central hololithic table, trying to coax detail from the poor quality images. Telemachon had joined us, watching with disinterest. Falcus and his brethren were still silent, shut away in their sanctuary.
"I'll fly the gunship," Telemachon offered.
"You can't trust him," said Asher Kai.
"He is mine now. I trust him as I trust you. Let that be the end of it."
"Very well. I will remain on the bridge and be ready to open a conduit if necessary. No guarantees, however. Psychic contact will be unpredictable at best. The world is a turgid mess."
Everyone knew what to do. I sent them to their duties and arranged to meet Telemachon and Lahore at the gunship within the hour. Nefertari refused to let me leave without a final demand to join me. She intercepted me in one of the starboard mustering halls, soaring down from the high gothic ceiling of a chamber lit only by the dust-shrouded stars outside the observation windows. She landed with a purr of armored joints, as gracefully as a human would descend the final stair of a staircase. How she gained those wings was a tale in itself, for though she had mastered them, she had not been born with them. Her closeness brought the blessed silence of a mind I couldn't easily read, and I treasured her for that. Inside her head was an aura of cold, exotic silence, rather than the rolling murmurs of memory and emotion that made up the minds of living humans. Even worse was the yearning, whispering void in the souls of all my rubrikai. Nefertari's mere presence soothed me, as it always did.
"Was Kartha?"
She greeted me with her kind's word for master, though she never used it with a smile.
"I'm coming with you."
"Not this time."
"I am your blood ward."
"There is nothing in there capable of harming me, Nefertari. My blood needs no warding."
"And if you are wrong?"
"Then I will kill whatever lies in ambush." I rested my hand on the skin-bound case of tarot cards chained to my hip. She didn't nod, because nodding is a human gesture, but I sensed her give in.
It is a time of change,
she said, and the words prickled my spine. She was unknowingly echoing Gaia's warning from before. What has changed?
I have been watching. Watching the wolf. Watching your new brothers. Watching you. Why are we really here, Kion? Why bring us to this place, on the grave birth's very edge?
I sense this is a rhetorical question. She tilted her head as she met my stare. Nefertari had the most arresting black eyes. Despite their alien slant, or perhaps because of it, they forever suggested more than she let leave her lips. Ashokai once told me that I was imagining Mystique, purely because I couldn't easily read the alien maiden's mind. He was ever dubious of my bond with my blood ward.
Rhetorical,
she said in her knife-unsheathing voice.
I do not know that word.
It means to ask a question when you already have the answer, for the sake of proving a point. As she paced, she stroked her gauntleted fingers across the nearby wall. The clawed nail, ending each finger, was a thing of bioluminescent, living crimson crystal. They scraped along the metal with the sound of distant screeching.
No, the question was not rhetorical. I wish to know why we are here.
To help Falcus.
And why does that matter to you? Do you also seek the warship he sought? The Archtraitor's flagship?
It was called the Vengeful Spirit. The Talok's entire crew was a tenth of what a Gloriana battleship would require. She sneered at the name.
And is that what lies at the bottom of this canyon?
I do not know, Nefertari. Gaia prowled closer to the Eldar maiden. Nefertari ran her gloved fingers through the wolf's fur, whispering for a moment in her serpentine tongue. They were my closest companions, yet their newfound closeness still set my teeth on edge.
You are lying to me, Iskander,
she said softly.
Not about what you know, but about why you are here, and about what you want. You want that ship.
I told you I have no way of crewing it. Her black eyes met mine.
But you do, for you have something possessed by no other warlord. You have Itsara.
My silence spoke for me. My heart was an open book to her, and she needed nothing more to see the truth. I stared at Nefertari. She stared back.
Gaia and I can feel the change within you,
she said,
even if you can't feel it yourself. In ignorance, my people gave birth to the youngest goddess, called She Who Thirsts. With her birth cry, she burned our empire. With her first breath, she swallowed our souls. She craves them still, suckling upon our spirits from the shadows. So I sacrifice the souls of others to this goddess, drinking their pain to ease my own. Their shrieks become songs. The sticky rattles of their final breaths are the lullabies that let me sleep. This is the fate of my people, who hunt me still, even in my exile. I understand what it means to be alone, Kion, and I smell the scent in others. You are so very alone. It is killing you.
I am not alone. I have Ashokai and Lahore. I have Telemachon. I have Gaia.
Your albino former master. A brain-damaged fool who follows you without knowing why. A degenerate enslaved to you by sorcery. And a demon in the body of the beast that almost killed you.
Silence passed between us once more. I have you, I said at last. That made her smile. She was centuries old by that point, older than I or any of my brothers, yet she seemed scarcely on the cusp of leaving her alien adolescence.
You have me,
she allowed.
But let us not pretend that is enough. You aren't human, no matter that you possess a human core. You are a weapon, made to be bonded with brother weapons.
That is the bond you were born to feel, and you are diminished without it. That need is why you welcomed Firefist and Ugrivian into the crew. It is why you saved Falcus and his men. Your heart is poisoned and you are alone. Yet you were born to exult in your brotherhood. So finally you fight. You feel the stirring of ambition and seek the grandest ship of all. At last you fight the solitude that has threatened you for so long. But will it be enough?
I was held rapt by her every word. Gaia had shared her feral perceptions of this change, but Nefertari's lucid and patient explanation captivated me. She slipped closer in a fluid slink, opening and closing her hand, making the crystal claws click.
Will it be enough?
She asked again.
You were born into brotherhood, but weapons need to be wielded, do they not? And there is no longer anyone to guide you, Kion. No emperor pointing from his throne and shouting for his sons to claim the stars in his name. No King One-Eye peering into the darkest depths of the Sea of Souls and demanding you dive with him into damnation.
I serve no one but myself.
Such blunt, stupid pride. I speak of unity, and you fear that I speak of slavery. Unity, Vaskatha. To be part of something bigger beyond yourself. Without your former overlords controlling your path, you should be free.
I am free. She came closer, too close. Had anyone else touched me as she did in that moment, I would have killed them for the discomfort. But she was mine, my Nefertari. So I allowed her the indulgence of running her gloved, clawed fingertip down my cheek. And do not mistake intimacy for sensuality. There was nothing of lust in that moment, merely raw, intimate closeness.
If you were free,
she whispered,
you would no longer dream of wolves.
My blood ran cold at those words. Without any way of reading my mind, she was still speaking my own thoughts aloud.
Do you know what you are, Vaskatha?
I confess that I did not.
You are a warrior with no war, a student with no teacher, and a teacher with no students. You are content to exist, and existence without pleasure is no different from decay. If you remain passive, if you allow the galaxy to exert its pressure against you without ever fighting back, then you are no different from Mekari, Jeddor, and the other dead men who walk in your shadow. Worse, you will be no different from your beloved, mourned Itzara.
I felt my teeth clench. Both my hearts beat harder.
Just like her,
Nefertari smiled,
floating in her tank of life-giving liquid, staring out at her tomb chamber with dead eyes that know nothing of hope. She had a reason to become the Anamnesis. Had she remained mortal, a mindless life and a young death were all that awaited her. What is your excuse for sealing yourself in such stasis?
I did not trust my voice in that moment. The hesitation made her smile.
You threw off the chains that bound you. You cast aside the Emperor's design for you, and for all your brothers. What have you gained, Kion? What joy is there in this life? What have you done with the freedom you bought through blood and fire?
I...
Hush. One last matter remains.
Her eyes locked to mine.
You are changing, but not all will change with you. There will come a day when you must kill Ashokai. I promise you that. You begin this path together, but you will finish it without him.
You are wrong. He's my closest brother.
For now, he is. For now. I've made my promise. We'll see how it plays out.
Nefertari's smile faded. She licked the taste of my sweat from her clawed fingertip.
Disgusting, Mankai,
she said softly. A last brush of eye contact was all the dismissal I had before she turned and took to the air once more. Once she was gone, my wolf regarded me with malignant white eyes. Did I sense another lecture in that inhuman stare, or simply amusement? I moved on without a word. My wolf followed, as she always followed. The night I walked the surface of As-Sir-Al, with the burning rain bleaching the cobalt paint from my armor, my attention kept drifting back to Lahore and Telemachon. Things had changed. I'd noticed it on the ship many times since Lahore and his warriors had come aboard, for the laughter and the clash of chain axes had a way of echoing through the corridors of an otherwise silent ship. But on the world's surface, we were alone. Isolation sharpened my perception of the differences between how things were and what they had become. The changes were that much clearer. Come, I had sent to them both, as I led the way down the gunship's gang ramp. Telemachon obeyed in irritated silence, but the World Eater was less sanguine.
I told you to stop doing that,
Lahore growled, following me onto the snow.
Get out of my head.
I hadn't even realized I was doing it, ordering them as though they were rubrikai. Nor did they follow in funereal silence as my rubrikai would, with dull movements matching mine. Lahore walked to the left, out of step with me, his axe hanging heavy in his hand and dragging through the snow. Telemachon's tread was lighter, more careful, hands resting on the pommels of his sheathed swords. Strangest of all, I could hear them both breathing over the vox. Lahore endured my glances for a while, then growled again.
Speak what's on your mind, Kaon, or look elsewhere.
It's nothing, I told him. You are just alive. At first I thought he would laugh, taking my words as meaningless sentimentality. Perhaps he wouldn't understand or not care. Instead, Lahore looked at me for several long seconds and then nodded. Just a nod. No more, no less. Despite everything we would go through together in the years to come, I do not believe I ever appreciated his presence by my side as much as in that moment. The power of simple brotherly understanding. I heard a wet sound from beneath Telemachon's helm, as what was left of his mouth peeled back from his teeth in a sickly grin. But his mockery was easy to ignore. The snow crunched beneath our boots, hissing beneath the rain's acidic kiss, refreezing as soon as it dissolved. The world was truly trapped in time, locked in a moment years or centuries before now. Temporal distortion is hardly unknown to the Eye's worlds, but the place still made my skin crawl. As-Sir-Al was broken unto death, yet it still lived. If time ever laid its touch upon this planet again, what would happen? Would it fly apart in a storm of asteroids, finally surrendering to cataclysm? I did not bother to scan the snowy landscape with a handheld Auspex. It would only read as 100 different frozen elements, or nothing remotely recognizable, in keeping with the maddening environments of all demon worlds in the Eye. I'd long since abandoned relying on such scans. Physics didn't apply with any consistency here, only the whims of whatever sentience shaped the Eye's worlds to their own desires. As-Sir-Al felt like a world uncontrolled, a sphere with its guiding mind lost. We couldn't communicate with the Talok. The vox was scrambled by atmospheric interference, and my bond with Ashokai was equally unreliable. Not long after we landed, I felt the kind of severance that usually comes with great distance. He was no longer with me in my mind. We pressed on through the rain, beginning our descent into the canyon. By the time we were halfway down the ravine, our armor had been acid-washed to dull metallic gray. Gaia walked in and out of the shadows, her black coat soaked in the stinging rain, though she was unharmed by the storm.
The lightning storm, flashing above the ravine, cast an abundance of shade for her to melt into and rise out of elsewhere. Occasionally, she used our shadows, cast as elongated silhouettes against the iced rock. Below us, the ship was submerged in the ocean of grey murk that filled the canyon's depths. Ashokai's summation had been accurate. The canyon could house a metropolis hive city and its 10 million souls. The scale of that ravine still chills my blood when I recall it, as does the sight of the drowned ship's tallest spires along its spinal battlements, thrusting defiantly above the mist. I knew then, before I set foot on the ship, before I even saw it fully, what I was looking at. The placing of the towers reaching up through the fog, their positioning and distance from one another. The ship's scale betrayed it, even though we were near blinded by the mist and several kilometers above it. Lihol made the same leap of logic in the very same moment. He swore in Nagrakali, calling my parentage into question.
"You were right," he said at the end of his maternally offensive tirade. "That thing's the size of..."
He trailed off.
"Something huge."
Telemachon gave a soft laugh.
"Oh, your Primarch must have been so proud to know your intellect matched his, Firefist."
The World Eater made no reply. I admired his restraint, though I could not help but wonder if it was purely because he lacked any cutting rejoinder. Lahore was above me as we descended a near-vertical patch of the canyon's wall, punching handholds and kicking footholds in the snow-blasted rock. Loose grit clattered against my helm as Lahore kicked another foothold into the frozen stone higher up.
"Imagine making a home on this hole of a world," he voxed.
Even the short distance was generating communication crackle between us. This world was brutal on our equipment. I dropped the last distance down onto a sloping rock ledge, digging in with my spiked boots. Telemachon was already waiting. Lahore was still 36 meters above.
"Now this is taking forever," he added. "We should have used jump packs."
There were no jump packs on the Talok, none still functioning at least. When I told him so, it earned a fresh set of curses. These were free of any mention of my mother, a woman I scarcely remembered anyway. She had dark eyes and skin the same rich caffeine shade as myself and Itsara. Her name had been... Ezhuri, yes. Ezhuri. She died on Prospero with the coming of the wolves. Lahore clambered down the rest of the way and dropped to the icy ledge alongside me. The shipwreck was still several kilometers below us, shrouded in the canyon's shadows, as well as the seething mist. "Go," I sent to Gaia. "Tell me if you find anything alive."
"Master,"
the wolf replied, and leapt into the darkness. I looked skywards, where the cloud cover was a poisoned grey caul over the heavens. Spots of acidic rain flecked across my eye lenses, but couldn't dissolve any part of my armor beyond the paint. Without a word, I started down the next slope, breaking the rock to make footholds. Deeper we went, into darkness. Another hour down and the rain no longer fell upon us. We were almost in the mist. I mused on the World Eater's presence as we descended. It was Lahore's way to face whatever came with an axe and a twitching grin. He seemed to consider too much planning to be no different from worrying, and to him, worrying was a lack of moral strength. From what I could tell so far, he also held the arrogant belief that death was simply something that happened to other warriors.
"Any word from your wolf?"
he voxed. "Nothing yet."
"You surround yourself with the strangest things," Lahore ventured. "The alien girl, the hell wolf, that irritating albino. Now that traitor with the swords. What did you do to him, anyway?"
I felt Telemachon's flare of annoyance at being spoken of as though he weren't here with us. Lahore continued on as if I'd answered, giving a list of the reasons I could never trust Telemachon and how I should have killed him to spare myself the trouble to come. I paid his commentary no mind. Gaia, I sent down towards the wreckage. Gaia. Nothing. Nothing at all. Be careful, I said to the others. I believe something is wrong. That made Lahore laugh.
Oh, it's tragic how that surprises you, sorcerer.
He laughed so easily. I started at the sound every time, the way a coward flinches at the sound of gunfire. I knew the ship's name the moment I walked on its ruined hull. A sense, at last, of nearby consciousness gripped me. All it took to confirm this twitch of my sixth sense was to place my palm against the ship's iron skin. Vengeful spirit. The concept resonated through the hull, toneless, lifeless. The ship's machine spirit, whatever was left of it, breathing its identity through metal bones. So the ship wasn't dead. Powered down and almost silent, but not dead. It hadn't crashed. From our first journeys across its surface, boots clanging on the ancient metal, we saw no evidence of lethal damage. The warship stretched for several kilometers, from cold engines to ramming prow, and the cloaking mist made our judgments more like guesses. But the vessel didn't look as though it had crashed at all. No obvious damage to the superstructure. No toppled battlement spires.
I've had an unwelcome thought,
Telemachon voxed, as the three of us traversed the external hull. Shadows of towers rose in the fog before us, like the promise of a city on the horizon. Go on.
What if this ship didn't crash? Is it even on the canyon's bottom? What if it's simply drifting here?
I had shared the same thought. The vessel was powered down. There was no way it could maintain position in an atmosphere without propulsion to counter the pull of gravity. If the ship was floating here as though in a void, that would mean it was somehow immune to the broken planet's gravitic pull. But the impossibility of the idea was no reason for it not to be real. Given the random and fluctuating nature of As-Sirral's dust-choked star system, I was counting on the evidence of my eyes, not the expectation of physics. The planet's unpredictable gravity was so unshackled by natural law that we hadn't even been able to pinpoint the planet's location in space. This was the empire of the eye. It was entirely possible that here, deep in the crust of a world frozen in time at the moment of its death, gravity had been cast aside, along with temporal reality.
Abaddon, I said in soft awe. Of all the hiding places.
Lahore stood with me, looking at the spinal towers rising up through the mist.
We should head inside.
Kion, said Telemachon behind us. I didn't answer either of them. I was still playing out the possibilities in my mind. Abaddon had taken the vengeful spirit past the fire tide of the radiant worlds, into the unscannable depths of the Eleusinian Veil, and powered the ship down beneath the surface of this broken world. The audacity of the plan took my breath away. No wonder the warship had remained unfound for so long.
Kion,
Lahore said this time. A moment, please. My hand against the hull trembled with echoes, teasing my mind with the scent of smoke, the sound of bolter fire, and the lurching sensation of the vessel's cannons firing in the skies above Terra.
Kion!
I lifted my palm from the metal.
What is it?
Lahore gestured with his pistol. I followed the motion to where a servo skull drifted further down the hull, bobbing in the mist. I just stared at it for several moments, unsure whether to believe my eyes. It kept coming closer, gently hovering. The merest expression of psychic influence dragged it through the air to land in my hand with a dull smack. An actual human skull, mounted with a tiny anti-gravitic generator which allowed it to float, with both of its eye sockets filled by picked recorders, sensor needles, and focusing lenses. A chromium spinal cord quivered in an obscene parody of life, thrashing helplessly at my arm as I clutched the skull probe in my hand. Its mechanical eyes clicked and whirred as they refocused on my faceplate. "Greetings," I said to it. Its reply was an alarmed blurt of distressed code from the minuscule vox speakers lodged in place of its upper incisors. The thing's articulated spinal column thrashed harder, a serpent coiling and uncoiling in a way no natural spine ever should. I wondered who was watching us through its eyes, assuming anyone was alive inside the ship at all. "I am Iskander Kion of the Kar Shahan. I come with Leorvine Ukris of the 15 Fangs and Telemachon Liras of the 3rd Legion. We are with Falcus of the Duraga Kal Esmihak. We seek Ezekiel Abaddon." Still, it thrashed in my grip.
"Well, let me see that," said Lahore.
I tossed the augmented skull to him, expecting him to catch it. Instead, as it labored in the air, trying to right itself on its weak anti-grav motor, Leor smashed it aside with a swing of his chain axe. Skull shards and metal shrapnel clattered across the shadowed hull. I looked at my brother for several moments.
"Another glorious victory," I said at last.
He grunted what may have been a laugh.
"Was that a joke, Kion? Be careful, else I'll begin to believe there's a soul trapped in that armor you wear."
Before I could reply, he tapped his toothed axe onto the hull beneath our boots.
"Shall we go inside?"
"The ship has several thousand access hatches," Telemachon pointed out. "You don't need to cut it." Lahore triggered the chain axe. Sparks sprayed as he started carving. Despite time's light touch on this world, the eye's influence showed throughout the vengeful spirit. The mist hid its external monstrousness, but the cold, cold threat of the flagship was perfectly evident inside. Many of the ship's corridors were calcified into a labyrinth of bleached bone architecture. Grey formations of lusterless crystal knuckled up from the joints and cracks in the bone walls. The entire vessel rang with the sense of journeying through the corpse of some great beast, dead for centuries. Sparse power still flowed through the downed warship, manifest in overhead lights and wall consoles. The former occasionally flickered. The screens of the latter were drowned by quiet static. The ship's main generators were still and lifeless. That much was obvious from the silence. What power existed was localized and faint, limited to a handful of systems. On several occasions, we were confronted by drifting servo skulls. I greeted them each time, repeating our names and our business aboard the vengeful spirit, hoping that whoever maintained them would witness our presence through the skull's eye lenses. Most scanned us or recorded us, then immediately sought to flee on their chittering anti-grav motors. Lahore let most of them drift away, though he shot three of them, claiming that if Abaddon cared about us breaking their toys, the first captain could damn well come and discuss it face to face. I found it hard to argue with such blunt initiative. Gaia remained silent all the while. After reaching for her once, I'd sensed her viciousness at my mere presence. Wherever she was hunting alone. Metal remembers everything. Exposure to the eye's tides had drawn forth memories from the ship's hull, manifesting echoes of the crew who had died serving aboard the flagship through the decades of the Great Crusade. Ghosts they were, formed from glass. Crystal faces leered from the bone walls, each one showing expressions of ugly harmony. The faces, so detailed as to be beyond even the work of a master sculptor, were masks of closed eyes and open mouths. If you moved close enough, you could see the crease lines on their lips. Even closer than that, and you could make out their paws.
"Well, even their ghosts are screaming," Lahore said.
"Don't be simple," Telemachon chided him. "Look closer."
The swordsman was right. Each face was unmarked by strain lines of torment around the eyes that one would expect from a shouting visage. These men and women may have died in pain, but their echoes were not screaming.
They are singing, said Telemachon.
I ran my gloved fingers down one of the visages, almost expecting its eyes to open and the song to rise from the glass mouth. These statues held life of a kind. A dull presence drifted behind their closed eyes, not entirely dissimilar to the weak life within my rubricae, but not quite the same. As I examined a crystal tongue, then the closed crystal eyes, I realized why the feeling was so familiar. It was the same spreading faintness of a soul leaving its fresh corpse in the maddening seconds before the gods pulled it into the warp.
Oh, these things make my skin itch, said Lahore. I swear they move when you don't look at them.
I wouldn't rule out the possibility, I replied. I touched one of them again, laying my fingertips against its forehead.
I am Kion.
A wordless pulse, a focused sense of my own identity.
I am alive,
it sang silently, in a melody made of whispered shrieks.
I screamed as the ship burned. I screamed as the fire sloughed the flesh from my bones. And now I sing.
I lifted my hand away once more. How captivating to see these serene faces as tomb markers for deaths of such agony. We had a similar custom on Prospero, forging exquisite burial masks for our fallen rulers. No matter how they died, we entombed them in a masquerade of golden serenity. Next, I touched the outstretched fingers of an arm, reaching from a joint in the ivory wall. I am Kion, I told this one.
I am alive. When I choked, I breathed the flames into my body. Every gasp sucked the fire into my throat. Blood filled my cooking lungs. And now I sing.
No more. That was enough. I lifted my touch away. At a sudden glassy crack, I turned to see Lahore idly swatting at the crystal hands reaching out from the bone walls. They shattered as he slapped them with his gauntleted palm. Stop that, I said. Each one he broke sent a lance of nasty buzzing heat through my temples.
What? Why?
He backhanded another straining arm, breaking it halfway along its length. The crystal stump remained, severed at the forearm, while the hand and wrist shattered on the bone deck in tinkling shards. For a moment, the pain in my head went from heat to fire. They are psychically resonant. You're making them sing, and the song is not a pleasant one. He stopped.
Well, you can hear them.
Yes, be glad you cannot. We moved on to yet another T-junction. Lahore gestured left with his axe.
Well, the median longitudinal corridor is this way.
We're not going to the bridge. He was still looking down the hallway leading to one of the vessel's main spinal thoroughfares.
We should go to the command deck, he said.
We will. But I'm going this way first.
Why?
I aim Saeern down the opposite hallway. A veritable forest of grey crystal limbs was motionlessly reaching from the corridor's walls, ceiling, and deck. I didn't need to touch them to hear their whispers. Clustered together, their weak psychic resonance was amplified enough to make my teeth itch.
Admittedly, Lahore replied, that does look promising.
We walked onwards, careful not to touch the crystalline hands. Damage stood out in stark contrast where the walls were still dark iron and clean steel. The ship had fought in the skies above Terra, boarded in the siege's final hours by countless strike teams of the Emperor's elite. Their legacy was written on the cold metal in pockmarks of bolter shell impacts and burn smears of laser scorching.
Do you feel anyone?
Lahore asked. I will need clearer context before I can answer that.
Feel them. Sense them with magic.
Magic again. The ship's machine spirit is in coma somnolence. There is life elsewhere, but I cannot be certain of its source. It may be nothing more than the ship's crystal ghosts, or the sentience of the world itself dripping into the vessel's bones. Everything feels alive, but it is a distorted, unfocused thing. Lihor swore as his elbow cracked off a few reaching fingers. I winced, but said nothing. We moved on. Lihor was twitching every few steps, his fingers clenching and teeth grinding. I kept hearing him whisper over the vox.
Oh, it's these crystals, he said when he saw me staring.
There was a porcelain squeal as his teeth clenched again.
That's why I was breaking them. They make my nails bite.
Pain haloed him. He wore an invisible crown of it, and unborn demons too weak to take form caressed his armor as he passed.
More,
they begged, desperate for sustenance, pleading for the fuel that would allow them to exist. I doubted most Neverborn felt Telemachon's presence at all. He felt almost no emotion since I'd stripped his nerves and brain clean of sensation. I had seen him through Gaia's eyes many times since his remaking, and his soulfire was a weak and insignificant thing when he was away from me. He would stand idle in chambers, almost as motionless as a rubrikai, breathing and staring, at one with whatever thoughts remained in his skull. Only when he was near me did sensation return to his mind. By such temptation was his loyalty secured. He hated me as much as he needed me. Time moves strangely in the vengeful spirit's cold halls. My retinal display tracked the seconds, passing in a brutally slow crawl, while Lahore reported that his chronometer settings were running in reverse. More than once I saw the crystalline echoes of the dead crew move at the edge of my sight. They were not all human. Many were warriors of the Legiones Astartes, reborn as echoes aboard the flagship where they had died. Custodians in exquisitely detailed armor and battle-scarred imperial fists reached from the walls, the ceilings, the floor decking, all singing silent funeral songs of flame and fury. Some carried war spears, others hefted boarding shields, most clutched bolters in fists that would never fire a weapon again. One of them, a manifestation of a helmeted Imperial Fists legionary, cut from grey glass, shattered into jagged shards as I drew near. It sent a buzz of pain through my temples, yet I heard Lihor grunt in something like relief. His cranial implants had been biting hard into the meat of his mind as we approached the glass revenant, and they eased with its shattering. When I think of the vengeful spirit now, I remember what we made of it after so many millennia of living aboard and sailing it to war. It was so very different that night, when the three of us first walked its powered-down chambers. Even with its systems offline and the machine spirit starved of all life, the cloying darkness was oppressive rather than barren. The legends stated it had been abandoned, but it felt hidden, waiting. Not hollow, not empty. I cannot tell you how long we walked in that pregnant darkness. An hour, three, ten. Time had no meaning there on that night. I remember that we passed through a power crucible, a chamber of inactive secondary generators leering at us from the shadows with the malice of slumbering gargoyles. It was on the other side of the chamber, as we entered the labyrinth of corridors once more, that a sine wave rose and fell at the edge of my retinal display, tracking a new sound. Footsteps, heavy and slow. Ceramites on the bone deck.
Kion,
Lihor warned, raising a hand to stop our advance. I hear it. A target lock immediately played over the newcomer as he rounded the junction ahead of us. He wore weathered and color-faded armor, scavenged and cannibalized from warriors of all nine legions, with a long fall of ratty, snarled black hair stringing across his features, half-hiding his face. Even from this distance, I saw gold in his gaze. Unnatural, inhuman gold, turning his irises a metallic shade. In his fists he carried a bolter, just as plain and just as battered as his warplate. Rather than take aim, he kept the weapon lowered, loose in his hands. The vox crackled as his suit's systems auto-cycled into our shared channel.
Oh, thank you to stop breaking my servo skulls.
A resonant voice, gravelly but without rawness, feigned for effect. A smiling voice. I am Iskandar Kayon, and this...
I know who you are. I knew even before you repeated your name to every servo skull that found you.
We have given you our names, cousin. What is yours? The Sons of Horus Legionary inclined his head before replying.
What exactly was the purpose of destroying those servo skulls? It seemed likely to get someone's attention, said Lahore. Blunt logic is the hardest to argue. Try not to break anything else while you're aboard. Really, brothers, civility mustn't break down, else we'll have nothing left.
He seemed to be paying us little attention now, looking down at an Auspex built into his vambrace. I heard it giving the heartbeat, thud, 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 of echolocation tracking.
The three of you came alone?
Yes, I said.
Where is Falkus, Ugrivian, Ashakai?
Aboard my ship in orbit. Who are you? Name yourself.
I used to be on thousands of hololiths across the length and breadth of the Imperium. Now you're telling me I'm not even recognized by warriors of the Legiones Astartes.
Our silence in response made him chuckle, dark and low.
How the mighty have fallen,
he added. The warrior raked his armored fingers through the mane of filthy hair, revealing a pitted pale face that defied any attempt to discern his age. He could have been 30 or 3,000. War was written across his features in a lattice of old cuts and the pockmarks of heat scarring. Battle marked him, even if age had not. Eyes of sick, slick gold watched us without blinking. Amusement flickered there, warming his cold, metallic stare. And that was how I knew him. He no longer wore the great black warplate of the Justerin, nor was his hair bound up in the ceremonial topknot of the Chthonian subterranean work gangs. He was a hollow shadow of the invincible warrior who once graced victory hololithics and imperial propaganda transmissions. But I knew him the moment he met my eyes and shared his dry, bladed amusement. I had seen that glance before. I had seen that expression on terror as the palace burned around us. He looked at the three of us as we wordlessly stared. Lahore was the one to break the stalemate, doing so with an absolute failure of diplomacy.
Drop your weapon, Captain Abaddon. We're here to steal your ship.